The Facebook Effect.
Is that why the markets are feeling so blue?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. It's Friday, May 25th.
Coming up, the view from the bottom of the economic ladder.
The economics behind a Scottish plan to go rogue.
And when the weather doesn't cooperate, one reporter takes matters into his own hands.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Tokyo stocks are having their worst losing streak in about 20 years, 8 straight weeks of declines. It's no wonder when you think about it. There's uncertainty about Greece, for instance, leaving the euro, a slowdown in China. Even the bright spot that could have been a successful Facebook IPO turned out to be a bit of a flop. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports on what all this is doing to our psyche.
Socializing on Facebook can be a distraction, but the company's Wall Street-faced plant stole investors' attention this week, too. While we were networking, U.S. business orders slowed. HP laid off 27,000 workers. And the big question, how it's going in Europe, remains unanswered. Stock strategist Rod Smith is with Riverfront Capital in Richmond, Virginia.
Instead of Facebook, Americans should be focused on the elections that recently happened in France and the clear change of message, which is a rejection of German austerity.
Germany versus the rest of Europe suggests a political fix for the eurozone remains far off. At least there's China, right? Not so much. Factory action there has slowed, too. All told, the International Monetary Fund thinks the world economy will grow slower than last year. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Well, the uncertainty in the markets is not what concerns our next guest. She's got enough to deal with. Sister Albertina Morales is a nun with the Sisters of Social Service Order here in Los Angeles. She helps run a community center called Regis House, which moved several years ago from West L.A. to a more troubled neighborhood near downtown L.A. As part of our coverage of wealth and poverty, I stopped by Regis House for a visit.
Before, it was a check cashing, money wiring place. Mm-hmm. And people still walk by looking for it. What happened to King's Express? And do we cash checks? No, we don't. We don't wire money. We don't cash checks. They haven't been here, obviously, for 5 years.
Who are the people that you serve, and what is your mission?
Our mission is to serve the marginalized, the disadvantaged, and families who are just living with each other, 1, 2, 3 families together, to be able to afford to survive. And most of our families are in survival mode.
Kenneth, you want to get in line, please?
Many of those families have children who spend a lot of time here.
Hi, Leslie. We're having peanut butter and jelly. Would you like some today?
Yes, please.
Sister Morales says that when it comes to kids, Regis House is stepping in where the government has had to step out.
We see what the cuts in the school system are doing. They are overcrowded. Kids are not getting the attention they need. They've taken some of the basic things out of the school, arts and crafts. Some kids don't even know how to use scissors.
Wow.
So homework assistance is a big deal. Snack is a big deal to these children.
Just giving them something to eat.
Just giving them something to eat. And sometimes they lick their plates clean, and it's a little bit sad for us, but that's their story.
In a sense, you have a very unique snapshot of the economy right now, because you're dealing with people on a daily basis who are, as you say, immigrants. They are maybe not so well off. They have children, and they're coming in here asking for help with all of those things. What are you seeing right now? Are things getting better? Are they getting worse? Are they staying the same?
Oh, pretty much the same. It's still a lot of unemployment. You know, someone will walk in and say, we just lost our jobs. We need food. We need clothing. We have not seen anything change.
Given the experience that you've had working with these people, what would the message be that you would have for people around the country?
People are hungry. People are barely surviving. It's important to know that we are all connected, that when one of us is not taken care of, that is a ripple effect that It's our obligation to help others and take care of other people.
Sister Albertina Morales here at the Regis House, thank you so much for talking with us and, more importantly, for everything you do.
Thank you for having me.
Now let's get some reaction from our regular Friday guest, Chris Lowe. He's chief economist with FTN Financial, and he's with us, as always, from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what did you make of what Sister Morales just said about the fact that, from her vantage point working with the poor here in Los Angeles, that the economy is not getting any better?
Well, I tell you what, the first thing is it really puts a human face on the numbers that we look at every day. But this is what we're talking about when we talk about the lowest labor force participation rate since 1982. What that means is 2.5 million people have become so discouraged they're not looking for work. This is also what we're talking about when we say that we've never had income growth so low outside of a recession. It is so evident in the data exactly what she's talking about, that there are still many, many people struggling. The other thing, unfortunately, is that unskilled workers have been hit harder by this recession than skilled workers, because there's still this huge demand for work outside the U.S. where wages are lower.
Chris, let me ask you about something else that happened this week that may have put a damper on all of our spirits, which is this Facebook IPO, which just flopped a week ago. And I wonder if that sort of made us think differently about the tech sector, which has been such a bright spot.
You know, there are people saying that. My sense is that was such a badly handled IPO. It's probably a mistake to read too much into it. You know, for example, during the sales pitches, the company refused to talk about their financial numbers. So there were plenty of things that could have gone wrong. Tech is slowing down, though, and it's slowing down primarily because there was a vibrant market in Asia and in Latin America. Those emerging markets were growing rapidly last year. They are slowing hard this year, and so orders are dropping.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Supporters of cutting Scotland loose from the rest of the United Kingdom kicked off their independence campaign today. The aim: dissolve the 305-year-old union with the rest of Britain. They're pushing for a vote on the question, perhaps within 2 years. A key part of the UK's wealth is the black gold under the North Sea, which would be Scottish territory. John McLaren is an economist for the Centre for Public Policy for Regions in Glasgow. Professor McLaren, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me how fossil fuel production, oil and gas in the North Sea, play out in this debate over an independent Scotland.
Yes, it's kind of the most important, or one of the most important elements of how well Scotland would do and how wealthy it would be post-independence, because about 80% to 90% of North Sea oil would probably be apportioned to Scotland, and so the UK would lose that, but it would also lose, to some extent, money that it currently transfers to Scotland.
And it is really quite complicated, because while some Scottish politicians that favour independence talk about Scotland becoming the wealthiest country in the world, oil revenues, they often go to multinational corporations that are based all sorts of places.
Yes, I think the idea that Scotland would overnight become some sort of very rich country, much richer than it is now, is really spurious. What would happen is that most of the North Sea, it would look like Scotland's GDP and wealth had increased a lot, but actually most of the North Sea is owned by overseas companies, as you say. And so really, all you would get is the tax take from that. All the profits would still pretty much go overseas.
And even if there were some sort of political independence, the ties between Scotland as a country and what will be the rest of the UK would remain extensive.
It's looking like the ties would be pretty extensive. It's looking like Scotland might still be part of the sterling currency. It's looking like the Queen might still rule in Scotland as well. So it's sort of like a modern form of independence, if you like.
Well, John McLaren is an economist at the Center for Public Policy for Regions in Glasgow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here in this country, there are smoking bans in workplaces and restaurants, but New Zealand could go even further and make the entire nation smoke-free. The BBC's Colin Peacock has the story from Wellington, New Zealand.
You can't smoke in bars here. You can't smoke in government buildings or even outside in some public parks. And soon, stores won't be allowed to display cigarettes on their shelves or counters. But the government here is going even further. This week, they announced that the already high price of cigarettes will rise by 40% over the next 4 years to more than $15 a pack. It's all part of a politically driven effort to stub out smoking in New Zealand completely by 2025. Politician Tariana Turia supports the measures. She leads the party which represents the indigenous Māori people, who are the country's heaviest smokers.
My cousins have all died before they were 55. I don't think that having a substance that kills people should be allowed to be sold. I have to ask why.
But smokers complain that their right to choose is being trampled, and local cigarette company Imperial Tobacco warns that the price increases will merely create a black market for tobacco, resulting in lost jobs and less revenue for the government. In Wellington, I'm the BBC's Colin Peacock for Marketplace.
What's in a name? When it comes to a famous one like Ford, there could be more than $1 billion involved. That's what marketers are making these days, just selling the company's trademarks on all kinds of merchandise. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
This week, Ford's improving financial health allowed the carmaker to take back control of its famous blue oval logo, which Ford had essentially pawned as collateral for the big loan that helped it survive. Chairman Bill Ford sounded relieved.
It really means that Ford is back.
He may not have been exaggerating. A report from Forbes says the blue oval logo has become the company's hottest property in a booming product licensing business. Goods ranging from Hot Wheels toys to built Ford Tough T-shirts for girls now take in $1.5 billion a year. And the value goes far beyond that, so says Pete Canalicchio, a branding expert at the Blake Project.
The impact could be quite high.
Take, for example, the new Forza 4 video game, which licenses images of Ford's cars. An added boost comes when fans talk up their virtual Fords in racing replays they post to YouTube.
If you've got consumers playing a video game and getting jazzed up about automobiles that Ford is producing, kudos to Ford. They're connecting with their consumer in such a powerful way.
That doesn't mean Ford is taking every opportunity that comes along. It's steering clear of tie-ins with alcohol and gun makers. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We want to check back now on the economic fallout from a food safety disaster that was in the news some months ago.
Last fall, a listeria outbreak traced to cantaloupes from a Colorado farm killed 30 people and sickened dozens more in 28 states. Demand for the melons was cut in half. And now as cantaloupe farmers gear up for this year's season, they're working to repair the melon's image. Kirk Siegler of KUNC sent this report from the Rocky Ford Cantaloupe region in southeast Colorado.
For more than a century, farmers have grown cantaloupes along the fertile Arkansas River Valley.
Cantaloupe here is, it's almost a culture.
Fourth-generation farmer Michael Hiracata walks between rows of raised dirt covered in plastic.
The local high school in Rocky Ford, their mascot is a meloneer, and it's a melon man. It's part of our culture and tradition and family.
A tradition tarnished by last fall's listeria outbreak. Beyond the tragedy of the deaths, it led to calls for more regulation. To better protect the local cantaloupe industry, Hiracata and his neighbors banded together and formed a growers' association. To become a certified member, farmers must agree to safety visits from third-party inspectors, something that's still voluntary under federal law. They also take courses on food safety and handling. Hiracata even hired his own food safety manager.
It's a big investment, but we want to show that we are committed to providing a good, quality, safe product.
But some farmers think planting cantaloupes will be too risky. Mike Bartolo is a crop specialist with Colorado State University. For example, he says corn is selling for really high prices right now.
I don't think there's any doubt there's going to be a decreased amount of acres. There's going to be less melons sold. That'll have some kind of an impact on this community and the economics here.
This is one of the poorest parts of Colorado. So $8 million in cantaloupe sales every year is a big deal here. And farmers like Michael Hiracata can only hope their strategies will pay off. But no one knows for sure whether shoppers in the region's large grocery chains will buy Rocky Ford cantaloupe.
It's hard planning right now for what's going to happen this year. So that's why we're taking baby steps right now.
Hirakata is planting in phases, so there will be several cantaloupe harvests instead of one big crop. He wants to shield himself if there is a big drop in demand. In Rocky Ford, Colorado, I'm Kirk Sigler for Marketplace.
All right, Jeremy, how about a handy device for relief from the euro crisis?
All right, what do you got?
Bloomberg Businessweek invented it. The magazine's forthcoming cover, I don't know if you've seen it, it's a big black target with the words, bang head here. The printed instructions for relief from the financial mess, number one, place magazine on a hard surface, number two, bang head, number three, repeat as necessary. Just don't try it on the iPad version, right?
Yeah, ouch. Well, some food is getting pretty high-tech these days. There's instant macaroni and cheese and dinners you can microwave in the box. But the standard ketchup bottle is still pretty low-tech. You've still got to hit it in that place right in the middle just to get the ketchup out. Well, now, thanks to some MIT scientists, there may be a solution. Marketplace's Queena Kim reports.
It's called hydrophobic nano-coating, and it makes bottles non-stick. Honey, mayonnaise, ketchup slide out without leaving a trace of waste or guilt.
How many times did you have a ketchup bottle that's almost empty sitting in the fridge for like 6 months?
That's Kipra Varanasi, an associate professor at MIT.
When we were thinking about what would be the first product that we could get out, bottles became an obvious choice.
Bottles for sauces and condiments is a $17 billion business. And consumers have already shown that they're willing to pay more for the upside-down bottle, which tries to solve the same problem. Angie May runs Betty's Diner in Berkeley. And she's not so sure that customers are ready for nano-coating with their ketchup.
You don't want the customers thinking, I just heard about this weird thing, and now Betty's is serving that ketchup.
But they've got 2 years to think about it before bottles hit store shelves. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
And finally, David, I saw this great story from Romania where there's a TV reporter who was sent out to cover a sandstorm. But according to the UK's Metro newspaper, he got there a little late and he missed the actual sandstorm. But he was undeterred. This intrepid journalist had his production assistant stand to the side of the shot and kick sand in his direction to recreate the sandstorm for the viewers on the screen behind him. Unfortunately, the production assistant didn't realize that, in fact, he was in the camera shot while he was doing that.
Yeah, this guy ought to go into feature films where you don't actually have to tell the truth.
You don't have to worry about that sort of thing. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.